Good evening, friends. Well, Leslie Price, quite a few months ago, asked me to talk on a subject on which you cannot talk. To speak on the Atman, that which sees but cannot be seen, that which hears but cannot be heard, that which knows but cannot be known, that which comprehends but cannot be comprehended. I have to use the language of the mind, words. The mind which is an expression of the Atman, but the mind which cannot reach the Atman. What can I do? We can talk around the Atman, about manifestations of the Atman. The spirit within us, the spark of the divine, which radiates throughout the cosmos and through us. Years ago, when I first started at the TS in Australia, a young member told me, "We have only our mind to use." At the time, I didn't question what he said. Everything was just right. And of course, if he meant our consciousness, then it would be right. If he meant only the mind, then it would not be utterly right. The mind is an instrument of knowledge, a filter of consciousness. But consciousness is wider than the mind and includes not only this mental apprehension, but also the feeling quality and also the intuition, which makes us know straight away without any need of analyzing, categorizing, going from one point to another. So I hope you realize the difference. We're going to try to use our consciousness to look at the subject as a whole, but step by step, because I'm using the mind. And then finally, I hope we can go into a silence for a few moments to try to feel at least what it's all about. A nice way of setting about it is the way that was followed by the ancient sages of India. They showed us the way. In one of their stories in the Upanishads, it is stated that a great sage went to visit a king. Sometimes the king taught the sage. Sometimes the sage taught the king. In this case, the king, a well-known Janaka, asked the sage, "What serves as the light for man?" And the sage obviously did not want to tell the ultimate truth. So he said, the sunlight. For in the sunlight, man moves about, does his work, eats, rests. And when the sun has gone, what serves as the light of man? The moon serves as the light of man, because man under the moonlight can do his work, move about, and so on. And when the moon sets, what serves as the light of man? And you can see that the sage does not want to answer, to give the real answer. So he says, fire serves as the light of man, for by the light of the fire he can move about and does his work and so on. But when the sun has set and the moon has set and the fire is extinguished, what serves as the light of man? Sound serves as the light of man, for though he cannot see his hand, if he hears a sound, he can move towards that sound. But the king is not yet satisfied. We have here several expressions of light, but that is not what the king wanted. So when all these things are extinguished, when there is no sound, what serves as the light of man? And so Yajnavalkya is right. At the end, he's cornered, and he has to admit the Atman serves as the light of man. For the Atman lights everything within us. By its light, we see, we hear, we understand, we act. It radiates from us. It illuminates us. It penetrates everything, from the innermost to the outermost. I would like to have a look at this word, Atman, because these ancient Sanskrit words do give a clue to their meaning. Nobody has ever been able to derive it from a specific root and say that this is it. So what we can say is that we think it is derived from two roots. One is at, which should be an, which means to breathe, breath. And the other one is tman, which means self. Now notice breath, breathing. This is the ultimate. We cannot live without breathing. The divine breath, the pulse of nature, the pulse of man. The Atman, breath, wind, in ancient cosmogonies, and spirit are identified. The wind, says the Vedas, is the Atman of the world. Thy breath, Varuna, sounds through the universe. It is the Atman of the universe. We hear its sounds, but we do not know whence it comes. Something very similar to the gospel. This breath of ours is of the utmost importance. It is one of the outer manifestations of the Atman. I'm going to have a look at these outer manifestations of the Atman because they take us step by step to the innermost. One outer manifestation is the breath, which is itself the outer manifestation of prana, the life breath. It is the grossest expression of the life breath, which itself is not the breath, which is fire, which itself is the very breath of the Atman. When we breathe, we exhale something of the Atman. When we breathe inwardly, we breathe something of the outer and bring it back to the Atman. And when we sigh, we express our longing for that which is within us. Now, thinking and breathing are closely related. The mind is an outer expression of the Atman, but it is a very, very limited mirror of that which knows supremely. The mind is a filter. Turn outwards through the senses, looking at the outer world, getting from the senses all sensory data, assimilating it at a middle level, and then giving to the Atman the essence of the experience. If the experience is not of a high order, there will be nothing to be assimilated. It remains at the lower level. Now, you have those two expressions of the Atman. There will be a third which I shall relate later on. But for the moment, I would like to have a look at our states of consciousness because they have to do with the mind. And for this, I will tell you a story again from the Upanishads. They are a mind of treasures. The gods and the anti-gods had heard of the Atman, that which is the indestructible, from which everything emerges and to which everything returns. That which grants you all your desires. Now notice that. And so the gods and the anti-gods, I'm not going to call them the demons, they are the opposite of the gods. They decided to find out what is this Atman, which is usually translated by the self, the innermost self, which grants you all the riches that you want. So they went to the Lord of all beings, Prajapati, and they asked him, they wanted to know what is the Atman. And he made them stay 32 years with him. There's probably quite a meaning in that, probably getting them ready slowly in their consciousness until the point when they are ready to understand, to grasp something of this ungraspable subject. At the end of 32 years, he asked them why did they come to him. And so they told him. So he said, oh, the Atman is in the eye. E-Y-E. Do you mean in the water, what we see in the water, or in a mirror? Yes, yes. Have a look in the mirror in the water and you will see the self. Now notice this answer. It sounds ridiculous on the face of it, but there's a great depth in it. So they had a look in the mirror, and they said, in the mirror of the water, and they said, yes, we have seen the self. Oh, and now put on your best clothing and have a look. And so they had a look, and they said, yes, we have seen the self. We have seen even our fingernails and all our beautiful clothing. And so he said, you can go back to your people, the gods and the anti-gods. And so they went back. And the leader, Virochana, the leader of the anti-gods, was very, very happy. And he told the anti-gods, we have seen the self, we have known the self. But Indra, the leader of the gods, Indra represents the mind in the Vedas. He began to reflect, when the body is nicely dressed, then we see it nicely dressed. But what if the body is lame? It will be seen lame. What if it is blind? It will be seen blind. This is not an indestructible self. This is not the eternal that I'm looking after. So instead of going back to the gods, he went back to Prajapati and told him what he had found. So Prajapati kept him for another 32 years, at the end of which he said, now, the self is that which wanders about in dreams. For in dreams you are free from the body. You wander about and you do exactly what you like. So Indra went away. He was going back to the gods to tell them at last, I have found the self. And then he reflected, but in dreams I can suffer pain and anguish and all sorts of things. That is not the self. So he went back to Prajapati and told him, no, 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 that is not the self. And Prajapati kept him for another 32 years. And then he said, the self is found in deep sleep. That is the self. So Indra went away, and then he reflected. In deep sleep, nothing happens. Object, subject disappear. Consciousness disappears. It is like annihilation. That cannot be the indestructible self. No, no. So he went back to Prajapati. And Prajapati was very pleased with him because he was the only one who realized that all these are only expressions of something which transcends all these. So he kept him for another 5 years only. He graduated from 32 years to 5 years. And then he told him, what is that self? Now, of course, in words, it means nothing. I can say it is the old blazing being, the old blazing flame of life, which is within us, which urges us, pushes us forward always, which gives us the divine discontent, which makes us do things which we would never dream of doing, which is the small voice that speaks to us, that orders us, that hints, that has all sorts of things. Does it mean anything to us? Perhaps to some of us who have experienced it, it may. To others, it is just words. But now, the states of consciousness, well, obviously the story centers around these states of consciousness, are very important. They are the way to the Atman. So I would like to consider them in a little bit of details. The first state of consciousness is the waking state, where your consciousness is centered in your brain. And you are faced with the dichotomy of object, subject, I and thou. There is duality, positive, negative. This world of manifestation is based upon two poles, positive, negative, active, passive, object, subject, darkness, light, and so on. The purpose of the outgoing consciousness is to learn all that the state of duality can give you and to see clearly. So the mind or consciousness manifesting through the brain clarifies everything by learning to know the difference between the two poles of manifestation on which the universe is strong. Then you withdraw that consciousness to an inner level, the level which we call the dream level, which is still the level of the mind. At this level, the dichotomy between subject and object is not so strong. There is still a difference between the objective or the outer and the inner, but we weave a world of our own desires around the self, our self, our projection of the self, a world of multiplicity. There is still the world of multiplicity. And yet, the differences are getting attenuated much more. And something else comes through, which Jung psychology calls the unconscious, which is that part of us which, during the waking state of consciousness, we do not know, but which comes alive during the night and complements the waking consciousness and tells us certain things about ourselves, makes statements, gives warning, and so on, shows us in our true light very often through certain projections which we call dream. But as Indra realized, this is still a state of consciousness where there is duality. Whether this duality is multiplicity or duality does not matter. There are two. So let us withdraw this consciousness from this dream level further, and we reach that state which Prajapati called deep sleep, and which, you may wonder, deep sleep, a state of consciousness? And I must admit that for maybe 10 years I wondered, how could intelligent man like the sages of the Upanishads call sleep a state of consciousness? But of course, with the practice of meditation, you realize, slowly begin to realize what is meant. The vibrations of the mind slow down further and further and further until there is no more vibration. The mind stops. It is only in deep sleep that the mind stops altogether. Therefore, no more vibration. Therefore, from your point of brain consciousness, there is no consciousness. It has stopped. But if you practice meditation, the third state of consciousness, which is equivalent to sleep, you realize that there is an opening, an openness, a waiting, an expectancy, that in that state of consciousness, something is happening. Something has at last space and power to mature. The soil, S-O-I-L, of the soul, S-O-U-L, can be fertilized. This is what I mean by something is happening. And if you can go on consciously in this unconscious, seemingly unconscious state, then the mind, which is outward turn, and that is natural, turns slowly, slowly inward. And if you can still hold it without any thought, then it reflects the innermost, the sun. The Vedas called the Atman the sun of the universe. It is reflected on the mind. And you get this flash of tremendous consciousness. And you know, and nobody can tell you, no, it is wrong. You know, you have received this flash of consciousness, the supreme consciousness, and you know why the Upanishads say the Atman is the knower that cannot be known. The Atman is the one that sees but cannot be seen. How can we see the seer? How can we know the knower? At the objective level of seeing and seen, there are two. At the innermost level, there is only one. There is only the seer. There is only this tremendous consciousness which knows everything. And it is a question of reaching it. According to Vedanta, it is a question of turning round. That's why I had this insight of the mind turning round and seeing. But the mind is turned outwards, which makes it very, very difficult. For ages, as we have been evolving this mind of ours, we have evolved it to turn outwardly, to look at the world. And this is very right. But there comes a time in the life of the soul when, at long last, the call has come back to me. And this call is the divine discontent. So then we start to look inwardly, and we find nothing at first. There is, at the inner level, which stands between the outer and the innermost, there is the threshold which guards the innermost. And this threshold is made up of darkness, utter darkness, and voidness. I call it the desert. This we have to cross. And this is what makes it very difficult for the mind to cross, because the mind is that which gives form to everything. Everything for us has a form. Dimensions, you see, multiplicity, duality. If you reduce it all to duality, two things. Already it is the beginning of form. The mind makes the form. To go back to the innermost, that form has to disappear, and the mind is not at home with that. It is frightened of losing hold of all its landmarks. Everything to which it is used to, it has to let go. And you find in the Buddhist tradition those words, let go, in order to find the ultimate. So it needs courage to be able to face this void. And in this void of ours is hidden all our conditioning, which comes up to the surface of the consciousness as foam upon the surface of the waters. That is the first step. We have to face that foam. All those things that we don't like about ourselves and that we repress and repress or suppress have to be faced. If we do face it, then we absorb what we would ordinarily reject. Absorb and transmute. Because there is in that inner void this process of transmutation which turns the rubbish into the fertilized soul. It is the same as in nature, the soul of nature, to which you can put a whole lot of rubbish. And then the processes go on and on, and realize that it is done in the darkness of the soul, the earth. Mother Earth works in darkness. The divine within us, that fertile soil, works in darkness. And it is in this darkness that the processes of transmutation, sublimation go on and on, and help us along the path. Now, I would like to say a few words on the obstructions on the path. I said already that the Atman manifests through every level, through our whole constitution. It is not just in the heart, not just in the brain. It penetrates the whole of our constitution. But of course, it may have a specific center rather in one spot than in another. I know that it manifests wholly and higher than the human body, but its greatest point of contact with the human body, if you can put it that way, is in the heart. The heart chakra radiates the light of the Atma, and also the eye, E-Y-E, the human eyes. In fact, the eyes are what I call archetypal, because they are the image of the Atman. At the Atmic level, there are eyes. Though different, and yet they are eyes. That one speaks in contradiction. The Atman has no form, and yet there is some kind of a form, and the eyes are there. Not the mouth, not the nose, nothing of that, but the eyes. The eyes are archetypal. So through the human eyes, you have this light of the Atman, and through the heart, this light, life, love of the Atman manifests. The great obstacle to our realization of the Atman is the mind. But let us have a look at this now. There, you have the man and you have the woman. Each one has his own great obstacle. Now, we'll start with the woman, because the man will lead on to something else which I want to talk about. The woman's great obstacle is her limitation as a woman. And that limitation as a woman is her attachment. Why this attachment? Because she is the one who reproduces the race, the one who gives birth. And therefore she must be attached to the children, attached to what the children need, that is security, both for herself and her children, to everything that is connected with motherhood. She is attached by her very nature. Nature gives her that which is absolutely necessary. Now, on the path of return, this is an impediment. If she can surmount this attachment, which of course manifests in various things like clinging, security, and all that. I'm just reducing it to its ultimate attachment. If she can surmount this, then all she needs is love. All right. Now, the man, don't think that it is easier for the woman. It is not. It is just as difficult. But for the man, we have to analyze it a little bit more. Man has three main obstacles. One is power. One is mind, and one is sex. Now, why have I not talked of mind for the woman? The man's mind, let us say rather the intellect, the male intellect, has been developed far more than the woman's intellect, except now. If a woman has a very developed intellect, she has developed it as a man in the past. The male intellect by which I mean the power of logic, of reason, of categorizing, analyzing, is usually very strong and is the seat of pride. This is where pride resides. And that is an impediment which has to be overcome. It is also an obstacle to intuition. The more highly intellectual you are, the less the intuition works. If you can surrender your intellect, then the intuition will come through and the pride will go. It is very difficult. Now the other thing, I won't talk about power, but the other thing is sex. Sex is stronger. Generally, I'm speaking generally, please. Realize that. There are exceptions and so on, but generally, sex is stronger in men than in women, and it is necessary. But sex has to do with the life. The outermost and the grossest manifestation of the Atman is in the semen. Many people don't know that, and that makes sex extremely sacred and should not be tampered with. Now, in the woman, it is in the chakras, so it is quite different. But in the man, it is in the semen and should not be wasted. And this is why, in all the religions, there must be continence if you want to live, to tread the spiritual path. If you use sex for purposes for which it is not meant, then you are wasting the divine life. You are wasting the atomic energy. The one bringing this on, which is very important, is because of the Kundalini fire, which is coiled at the very base of the spine. If the man is not pure enough, and the Kundalini fire is awakened as it has to awaken when we tread the spiritual path and are on the way back to the Atman, the fire will go to the sex, and this is, let us say, madness. If you have learned control of all your powers, whether it's sex or mind, then it will go up. And that is the way that it should, on the spiritual path. Now what happens? Why has the Kundalini fire got to be awakened? Not by any external means, please. It awakens by itself. Because the Kundalini fire is the fire of matter. It is the essence of the energy of matter, which is the feminine energy. And Atma may be thought of as the masculine energy. And the two have to meet at the highest level. And they can only meet in a human being. Man in the physical body has everything. All the levels, all the planes are in him. So the two, the fire of matter and the fire of the spirit, have to meet in man at the highest level. Then he can realize God. Then the Atman is realized. And that is why everything that we do, if we want to realize the Atman, has to be done as a kind of surrender to the divine life that is within us. Nothing else but surrender will take us there. And surrender means not priding ourselves on anything, not inflating our ego, but surrendering the ego to the light within. Surrender means longing for the divine life, for the God within. We can look up to the Atman as our God, our Father in heaven. Actually, Madame Blavatsky refers to this when she says that when Christ referred to his Father in heaven, the esoteric meaning of this is the Atman. The Atman is our Father in heaven, to whom we can pray always, whose help we can ask, who is the listener, who is the watcher, who guides us, who is the guide. down the path to the Atman in order to try to grasp something of this inner life. We open our heart to that spiritual being, state of consciousness, whatever you like to call it, the light within us. The more we open our heart to it, the more it will manifest. Now, the Atman manifests, as I said, through the eyes, through the heart, in many ways. It manifests, for example, through the heart as waves of love to send to anyone, as rays of light, expressing themselves through the eyes. It manifests as a hint that we get when we are in despair. And suddenly, like a ray of light speaks to us. There is no word, or there are words. It depends upon us. And we know we must act this way. Or the hope has come back to us, and we are revitalized. We can live further. We accept our condition. Let's say we are very ill. We accept our condition. It manifests as a flash of lightning, which frightens us because we don't know what it means. But if we remember, the Atman is fire within us, and therefore some of its manifestations will be like lightning fire. Actually, the Vedas express God as fire, lightning fire, solar fire, and fire by friction of matter. The fire that arises from the wood, from the stone, and is hidden in the waters. All these are expressions of the divine life, which they found within themselves. We may think that it is very difficult for us to grasp something of this Atman. Well, I would say, practice meditation. Not the meditation so much, not so much the meditation of words. Words are a preliminary to the acceptance of the silence within. The mind is constantly going from one pole to another. The vortex of thoughts is going on and on and on and on. And that is why we are told we must cease to think. We must quieten the mind until the waves subside and they become like a mirror. Now notice in the little story that I told you, Prajapati said, look in the mirror, you will find the self. Of course, the eye is the reflection of the self. But Indra did not quite realize it, but he felt there's something wrong. I must go back. But Prajapati was not telling a lie. He was saying an esoteric truth. In the eye, you find the reflection of the Atman. And then he said, in a dream state, of course, in the state where the self is the king, the Atman is the king, the Atman decrees our life. We may think this is predestination, this is this, that, and the other. No. Who is the self? Is it this little self, personality, or is it the Atman? The self is the Atman. If the Atman decrees that I should live for so many years and that I should do certain things, it is its business and it is my business to follow. If I don't follow what it says, then I'm at loggerheads with my own self, and therefore there is disharmony, there is conflict, there is struggle. And what am I doing? I'm wasting my time, because finally the Atman will be the one who wins, because it is of God. And then we withdraw further. He said, it is sleep. And we think that's funny. Sleep? Of course. It is in this transmutation of the state of consciousness when there are no longer any vibrations that we can begin to get an inkling of the Atman, because in that state of perfect quietness, we begin to feel something of that dynamic presence, something utterly dynamic emerges within us, and we know that we have tremendous power within us, power that we can use, and here is the choice. Are we going to use it for the good or for the bad? Let us hope that when this manifests, we have trodden enough upon the path to know that nothing can take us back to evil. In this state of consciousness, where there is no vibration at all, we come in touch definitely with the three expressions of the Atman, which the Hindus called being, consciousness, and bliss. Now let us analyze that. Being. There being, I am. We cannot deny that. In the third state of consciousness, we know that we are. That is the only thing that we know. I am. There is being. But how to express it in words? If we can intuit it, very good. But this being, you cannot have being without being aware of something. Now you may think you are aware of nothing. No. You are aware. That's all. And you know intuitively, because the intuition works, you know that this awareness has to be turned inward, deeper and deeper, and it is a question of waiting. The longing and the dynamic state of being, the two together, waiting for this awareness to turn and mirror the sun within us. So we have being, consciousness, and bliss. Now, I call it joy. They call it bliss because they experience the highest bliss. But there's one thing that I discovered, and that this joy is love. The two are one at that level. Absolutely. There is no doubt about it. And it is interesting that the Hindus emphasize bliss. The Christians emphasize love. But notice, some of you, you may have been in love at one time or another. What happened? You were full of joy. Your heart was throbbing with joy. That is one expression of love. But that joy is nothing compared to the joy you experience in that state, the third state of consciousness, when you are expecting the divine lover. It is something utterly dynamic. The whole state is dynamic. The whole state is an expression of the Atman at that inner level, the middle level. This is an expression of the Atman, which all of us can experience. But it is nothing compared to the real state, of which only the mystics can speak. And now I would like to read to you an excerpt from Sri Krishna Prem, and then my favorite excerpts from Plotinus. I think this is very, very pertinent to us in a theosophical society, because we tend to lose ourselves in theories and to forget that if we want to be guides of humanity, as was the original idea, then we must experience the highest within us. I don't mean to experience the heights of the Atman, but to experience something of it, to experience its tremendous dynamism, its joy, its love, its being. And when you come out of it, you have power to help. We cannot really help until we have integrated something of ourselves. Now, Sri Krishna Prant was an ordinary Englishman, and I think he was even a graduate from Cambridge. But he went to India, and he had a lady guru, and then something happened. He got the illumination. He had an ashram, and he wrote commentaries on the secret doctrine, which are absolutely enlightened. And this is from Man the Measure of All Things, which is a commentary on the secret doctrine. The inner teaching has frequently been taken literally in its symbols, and the inner life of the spirit, the treading of the path to freedom, has been cramped and weighed down by vast and elaborate mental constructions, which, taken in and for themselves, press down upon the heart and check the spirit's soaring flight. Ground between cycles of an endless past and of an endless future, entangled in a maze of rounds and races, rooted on plains and paths, too often the heart of the disciple is crushed and he forgets that the eternal peace is round him and within him, here and now. If he but used the wisdom eye within his soul, even now, the whirling cycles shrink to a point and cease. Time and levels vanish, and only the bliss of unity remains. For now, not in some dim past or dimmer future, all is one number issued from no number. It is therefore within ourselves that we must seek the truth. Withdrawing our consciousness from the crust of material forms, we must attend to the living truth of which those forms are but the crystallized pattern. Nor, though difficult because of our inveterate outward-looking habit, is this in any way impossible for us here and now. It cannot be too strongly emphasized that now, at this very moment and for our very selves, the divine wisdom is available. Within us, yes, us, the sons of fire are now sounding forth their wisdom, born of the parent flame. Not in remote Himalayan caverns and to exceptional souls alone, but here in the caves of our own hearts the truth is being taught. It is we who do not listen and then fill earth and sky with clamor, wailing like peevish children for our supposedly forlorn state. Listen, ye sons of the earth, to your instructors, the sons of the fire, who are within and around you everywhere. I think this is a wonderful summing up of the whole of the question of the possibility of realizing something of the Atman here and now, if we want it. We have to want it. Desire is at the basis of everything. Desire, primordial seed of consciousness, in the beginning arose in that. Now this is a line from the Rig Veda. Desire has to be sublimated. Desire for the external world, for everything, has to be sublimated. But that which sublimates all our desires is itself desire that takes us back to God, desire for the Atman, desire for the truth, desire for the ultimate reality. It is desire, but a different kind of desire. And when we reach this ultimate, if we ever do, I've given hints that it is a complete illumination, that it is a complete love, that it is a complete transcendence of ourselves as human beings. But the one thing that people generally cannot understand is that it is a complete oneness. There is no longer two. There is only one. This we have to try to understand with our mind, and it is very difficult. But in the third state of consciousness, you realize something of it because you are in the state of nothingness. God is no thing, nothing. It is very frightening to plunge into nothingness, into the void. But once you have been able to hold on in that void, then you realize something which words cannot express. But the great mystics have tried to express this. Now we'll read you to finish two excerpts, one from Sri Aurobindo and one from Plotinus. Sri Aurobindo, at the gate of the transcendent stands that mere and perfect spirit, described in the Upanishads, luminous, pure, sustaining the world, but inactive in it, without sinews of energy, without flaw of duality, without scar of division, unique, identical, free from all appearance of relation and of multiplicity, the pure self, the inactive Brahman, the transcendent silence. And this is why, if someone asks, what is God? The best answer is silence. And now let us see what Plotinus has to say. For there, everything is transparent. Nothing dark, nothing resistant. Every being is lucid to every other in breadth and depth. Light runs through light. And each of them contains all within itself, and at the same time sees all in every other, so that everywhere there is all, all is all, and each all, and infinite the glory. Each of them is great, the small is great, the sun there is all the stars, and every star again is all the stars and sun. No doubt we should not speak of seeing, but we cannot help talking in dualities, seen and seer, instead of boldly the achievement of unity. In this seeing, we neither hold an object nor trace distinction. There is no two. The man is changed, no longer himself nor self-belonging. He is merged with the Supreme, sunken into it, one with it. Center coincides with center. For on this higher plane, things that touch at all are one. Only in separation is there duality. This is why the vision baffles telling. We cannot detach the Supreme to state it. If we have seen something thus detached, we have failed of the Supreme, which is to be known only as one with ourselves.